John Clayton.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios.
Streaming live at 710sports.com. On demand everywhere on the 710 Seattle Sports app. Now, John Clayton.
And still, things are cranking up in the National Football League. And even though baseball's had its miscues as far as how they've handled the virus, you know, basketball's going on. We've got the, you know, NFL training camp that's, you know, starting up right now. We've got a lot of news in the National Football League. And, you know, hockey's now going. So all things seem to be going pretty well. So we're not going to waste any time. We're going to get into the five biggest stories of the day.
Number one.
This news came down within just the past few minutes here. Antonio Brown suspended for the first 8 games of the regular season, at least, as details come out in that civil case. If further violations are found, that suspension could be even longer. Now, Brown is free to sign with any team at this time, and if he does, like any other player who is suspended for a finite number of games, he would be allowed to participate in training camp. The suspension, whether he is on a team or not, would take effect as of September 5th. The soonest we would see AB on a field this season would be week 9.
Well, of course, you can see that things got a little bit worse, and I guess you can see Antonio Brown got what he was asking for, because what he was asking for is that, well, I need a decision from what's coming from the commissioner. Well, even though they're not through with the final investigation, they lowered the 8-game suspension on him, and there's still one more case that's being investigated. There's a lawsuit by his former woman trainer that's talking about some sexual things that happened to her that she's suing him about, and so now we'll see if, because that's the case, and that's the case, I mean, that could take the 8-game suspension, maybe make it 12, because I think what you saw is that, you know, he gets suspended for his assault on the moving van driver, you know, that he pleaded guilty to 2 charges of assault. Then he had the case, which is a lawsuit, not a criminal case, but a lawsuit by his painter. He had a painter, woman painter, and she was making accusations of bad texts and things of that nature. And so that was included in this, and that's why it went up all the way to 8. And you have to figure there's a decent chance right now that it could be going more, because this sounds even worse on the trainer who is alleging that he did things even worse than what happened with the the person that was there as the artist. So in the end, and I have to think, if you're Seattle, do you really want to get involved with this, knowing that all you're going to be able to do is sign him now? He comes in, he then goes ahead, learns the offense, goes through the 14 padded practices, and then he's not allowed in the building for at least 8 weeks. I'd have to think right now it's not advisable to do. It's better to go another direction, naturally, because, you know, John Snyder's going to stay involved in just about everything. He'll keep the option open, but it's an option right now that I don't think is very good. All I know is that, Curtis, I'm just getting sick of the Antonio Brown story. You know, I hope he doesn't sign with anybody at this stage. If you're going to do something, let's talk about it in November.
All for it, John. All for us putting this off until November.
Just brutal.
Number two.
It's hard to imagine much can change right now, because we are on the precipice of the college football season. But change is coming, and it's not going to come fast enough for these players. And ultimately, the NCAA is to blame. The NCAA and the Power Five conferences, because they have been so slow to listen to the demands of the players. We're still not there yet on the name, image, and likeness, and that's been in the water now for forever.
That's Paul Feinbaum talking about the strange story that came out over the weekend, that a group of players in the Pac-12 sent a letter to the Players Tribune threatening to opt out of games unless their demands are met. And among them is Washington cornerback Elijah Molden and linebacker Joe Tryon. And so, I know that once the word got to Washington State, Nick Rolovich, the head coach, dismissed all the players for their involvement in the group. Okay, some of the things they're asking for is fair. You know, what they're asking for is, you know, better situations to make sure that they're safe. But the ridiculous part is asking for a 50-50 split of revenue, which is absolutely dumb. I mean, because again, right now, the sport itself is just trying to get on the field and try to do something. And now I have to think overall, this is kind of just crazy to think that you can get revenue sharing, but, you know, it's not going to work out. I know we're going to talk to Adam Rittenberg at 10:30 to help us try to get this thing figured out. Just absolutely brutal what they're asking for. But again, the safety part of it, I think, is okay. the monetary part of it, sure, it's late, but they're not going to do a 50-50 split when you know that they're going to be losing so much money with no fans or limited number of fans are in the stands.
Number three.
Here's the stretch. There goes long to third. Pitch on the way, and a swing and a miss by Nola. Foul tip into the glove of the catcher, Allen. He hangs onto it for strike three, and the ball game is over. The Oakland A's hang on and win it this afternoon. A final score of 3-2. Liam Hendricks, a save by striking out the side here in the bottom of the ninth, and the Mariners leave the tying run aboard in scoring position.
Yeah, so the Mariners played well this weekend. They got some great pitching, but unfortunately in the last two games, not enough runs scored, and so they ended up losing. And so they've lost two out of three right now to the A's. They're 5-6 on the season, but in both games, the Mariners did have the lead, and their starting pitching was very good. You know, Yusei Kikuchi looked fantastic. Six shutout innings, struck out nine, but as we all know, the bullpen is bull. It's not good. They just blew that opportunity. And then on Sunday, Kendall Graveman looked well, and he was going into the fifth inning, but a neck problem started to crop up, and so he had to go. So they lose that game on Sunday 3-2. Series is going to end tonight with Oakland getting the visit here. It's going to be 5 p.m. on the pregame, 6:10 on the game. It's going to be here on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Number four.
The players were furious because as part of his statement to our Carl Ravage, he mentioned the players have to do better, and that really angered the players. They felt like he was finger-pointing. John Lester of the Cubs, for example, responded, paraphrasing here, saying, hey, we're the ones who are taking the risk. But this is at the end of a week of finger-pointing from both sides. We had tweets from David Price, from Anthony Rizzo, calling into question parts of the health and safety protocol and whether safety was a priority. I can tell you behind the scenes, Major League Baseball Player Association, conversations all the time, they're working together. But this undercurrent of distrust and suspicion has been there all throughout this process.
Yeah, so Rob Manfred is just all over the place. It comes out on Friday and starts to notify the TV networks. We have to do alternating different type programming, you know, threatening to almost cancel the season. And again, his protocols are just so bad in the sense that you have to let players on the Marlins decide if they're playing as opposed to the league just saying, hey, listen, you got three positive tests, we're shutting it down. And so now you've got the Marlins, and you know, you here's the bad part about how bad baseball is at the moment. I mean, you've got some teams like the Mariners, you know, they've played 10 games, and you have other teams that play as few as three. I mean, just absolutely brutal. And, you know, so then they had the weekend series with the Cardinals. They pretty well canceled that because there was multiple positive tests. And now the Marlins reporting no more positive tests on Sunday. So they're probably seeing they're going to be able to resume on Tuesday against the Baltimore Orioles. But, you know, now all of, next thing you know, after saying on Friday, they're thinking about shutting it down. And now over the weekend to Carl Ravage, we are playing. The players need to be better, but I'm not a quitter. Well, right now you're not a very good commissioner.
Number five.
If you smile at all, what the XFL is cooking.
Well, Dwayne Rock Johnson ended up being part of a group that bought the XFL for $15 million. They're absorbing like about $8.5 million of some liabilities to carry over. But The Rock, who I was in a movie with, which was just absolutely great to be able to be with him. I was in the movie Game Plan. It had a little cameo scene that was in there. Spent a bunch of time talking to him. And, you know, he played for Dennis Erickson down at the University of Miami. So they were able to go ahead and get that going. But really good to see that, they have a lot of positive things going on. As far as what's going on with the XFL and see if they can survive that. You know, Rock is such a good force right now. You know, the average TV viewership was 1.9 last year, which is pretty good, and generated nearly $20 million of gross revenues in 2020, according to court papers. You know, that's what they were able to draw. So now what you're looking at is that The Rock trying to keep the sport alive here with the XFL. You know that ESPN will probably be getting the rights. We'll see if NBC does the same. But, it's great to see that The Rock is involved with that because I think, you know, spring football can be good. You know, we already know it's going to be competing against some college football, but we'll see how many, because right now the big five, power five, are looking like they are going to try to play. But overall, The Rock getting in there with his investment, along with all his other partners, for $15 million. So the XFL does have some hope. You can listen to the show via the 710 Sports app. It's powered by the Dubin Law Group. Coming up next, we're going to talk about the negotiations that's going on for George Kittle and the 49ers, which is not looking good right now. John Clayton Show, 710 ESPN Seattle.
Under further review with John Clayton.
We'll review the play.
Well, the interesting thing that we can see going on here, we've got training camp that's just about now starting, and of course, negotiations going on. That's really not a lot of positive ones because it's so tough to do a deal. I know I say that knowing that Joey Bosa just got $27 million. I know they say that knowing there was $25 million for Myles Garrett, but it's really tough for anybody to go give value for what guys are worth under the previous market. And now, of course, the market has changed because you've got no fans in the stands, or we don't know how much money some owners are budgeting that they're going to lose $150 million of revenue this year. And that's what they're kind of budgeting. And of course, you have to kind of figure that's going to affect the cap, which right now has a floor of $175 million. And so to get something done, you have to be very, very creative. Well, I know that we see stories now out of San Francisco that George Kittle is having trouble negotiating with the 49ers because he's taken the tact that, hey, I'm more than just a tight end. You figure that he sets the tight end market. Tight end market's at the top right now at 10.5. You figure $12, $13 million a year would do that. But now he wants to be like a wide receiver. And I don't know if that means he wants $20 million or he wants $17 million. But I can tell you right now, he's not going to get it. I know Mike Silver from the NFL Network talked about the negotiations which are stalling right now between Kittle and the 49ers.
We know George Kittle is the man. He's that hybrid tight end wide receiver, and he wants a new deal to compensate him as such. What is the status of that?
Well, Steve, there remains a pretty significant disconnect philosophically between the 49ers and George Kittle's camp. The 49ers believe they want to reset the tight end market and give him a great tight end deal. And Kittle's kind of saying, I think I'm more than just a tight end. And it's been a really flat market at that position. Jimmy Graham was kind of the standard off his 2014 deal. Austin Hooper eclipsed that by a little bit this past March in free agency. But if you look at him as a tight end, yeah, George Kittle could reset the market. But George Kittle, who was just voted the seventh best player in the league by his peers, and in my opinion has earned that distinction, is thinking, I don't want to be called a tight end for the purposes of these negotiations.
We've seen this before with Jimmy Graham. Kittle is slated to earn $2.1 million this season. Do you think he plays on that number?
You know, Steve, because of the unique offseason, there's a little time to figure this out, but if I'm George Kittle, I'm wondering, with the opt-out deadline coming up as early as August 7th, depending on when the new deal gets signed, do I want to play for $2.133 million, which is severely undervalued during a pandemic? Or do I want to take $150,000 and live to fight another year? I don't think it's come to that yet, but if I'm George Kittle, those thoughts are starting to form in my mind. And look, in defense of Kittle, look at the Chiefs. They got their house in order. They got Patrick Mahomes done in a way that allowed them to get Chris Jones done. They're talking about dynasties. The Niners got their coach Kyle Shanahan and GM John Lynch done, deserved, but this is something they need to do as a statement to their locker room, in my opinion, and the clock is ticking.
George Kittle, don't listen to a single word that Mike Silver's saying. I mean, you got to be kidding me. I mean, does Mike not know that if you then do the opt-out, your contract tolls for next year? So guess what his salary is going to be next year? $2.133 million, and he loses the chance to get free agency. So in other words, if he opts out, he's basically opting out of a whole bunch of money. Even if it's going to be $12 or $13 million, or even just the franchise tag, which unfortunately is going to probably drop significantly, but it's like, okay, so you out of negotiating purposes, do you want to play during a pandemic and make $150,000 this year and $2.133 million? Hey, listen, Mike, don't be an agent in this deal. If you are, you're being an agent for the 49ers, and you're not being the agent for the player, George Kittle. I mean, when I heard that, Curtis Rogers, I just shook my head. I was like, what are you thinking, Mike? Because, you basically are destroying all your leverage, and you're also destroying the opportunity to make money. It's like you're going to say no to $12, $13 million and accept $2.133 this year? Please.
Yeah, it makes zero sense that George Kittle would sit out for that reason in order to renegotiate again next year. He'd make what he's making now next year. He'd delay his free agency by a year. It would be terrible for his bank account if he chose to do that. Now, obviously, if he wants to opt out for actual legit health reasons, yeah, that's fine. That's fine. Whatever. But if you're going to opt out for financial reasons because you're unhappy with what your contract is right now, you're not going to get what you want any sooner than if you showed up to camp right now and showed up to play and showed up to negotiate. Because I feel like the 49ers are like, okay, you want to negotiate, well, show up. Like, where are you? We'll gladly talk, but right now, I mean, if he goes that route that Mike Silver has suggested, you could put him up there with Le'Veon Bell and Melvin Gordon as guys who would really like a do-over in how they handled their contract talks.
Or Jadeveon Clowney. It doesn't make any sense. I mean, again, if he has medical reasons why, that's understandable. But from the financial reasons, I mean, you know, he's getting a virus on his finances if he opts out for this season. Because, again, he loses everything as far as monetarily. And this guy is a great player, as voted by the NFL Network the seventh best player in the league, according to what the players think of him. He's that good, and he plays that well. But to do an opt-out like that, I mean, that would be ridiculous. I mean, we've seen 44, 45 opt-outs so far. I mean, we've seen, you know, starting defensive tackles. Juwan James just opted out. You know, he's the right tackle for the Denver Broncos, and there's so many opt-outs that we're seeing and hearing and watching and doing all those different things. But to think that you'd do something like that, that's Le'Veon Bellish, maybe even worse than Le'Veon Bellish. I mean, say what you want. It's like Le'Veon missed the $14.5 million he was going to make on a franchise tag and then came back and got $13.15. So at least he was able to get, you know, 2 years at $13.1, where in this case, you're getting 2 years at $2.133 million. Ridiculous.
John, based off what you've heard with the George Kittle negotiations and the 49ers, how far apart do you think both sides are in getting a deal done?
I'd say at least $5 million, at least.
Wow. Because
if he's asking for wide receiver money, which he's not going to get, you know, he's looking at the very bottom as like $17 or $18 million, and that's not going to happen. And, you know, and that's the thing I think that, you know, everybody's got to realize that, you know, we're really just in the beginning stages of negotiations where a lot of these guys aren't going to get their value and aren't going to get contract extensions, because it was, what, 2 weeks ago Friday that they had worked out the deal, what the cap was going to be for next year. And again, this is not the actual cap number. I mean, the floor is 175. I'm sure it's going to grow a little bit from there. How much, we don't know. But when you're talking about a team like San Francisco, which has George Kittle, Solomon Thomas, their top three cornerbacks, and about 20 players that right now are up, and they're at about $2 million under next year's cap. You know, they're at about 177 of the 175. It all doesn't work. And so if that's going to be the case, you know, you realize it's going to be tough. But it's like, technically, it's only been 2 weeks of negotiations. Sure, Mahomes got done, and Chris Jones got done, and, you know, Myles Garrett got done, and Joey Bosa got done, but there's not going to be a lot of deals. And if Kittle is thinking that he's going to be getting wide receiver money, it's like, okay, good luck on that one.
Yeah, definitely good luck on that one. And the 49ers know that they can't really be in a position to overpay right now because of their cap situation and how much against it they are, and how next year it's not going to increase really at all. So they're not going to have as much wiggle room next year as they do right now. And it just makes for a really, really tough negotiation, really tough situation for them in order to fit everything in. And it just kind of speaks to, you know, the difficulty of teams who do make those big splashes in free agency, you know, getting the band back together year after year after year, because those big contracts, they will destroy your cap if you're not careful, if you're not, you know, watching out for it. And there are plenty of guys on the 49ers due for extensions, and they're going to have to, you know, weigh the value of the players they sign in free agency over the players they already have.
Yeah, that's because just go see the Rams, and really the 49ers are in the same position as the Rams were. You know, they made the moves to get, you know, Kwame Alexander. They made the moves to trade for D Ford, paying him $17 million a year, and now they're going to pay the price. I can guarantee you this. The first two guys that won't be on the roster next year is going to be Kwame Alexander and D Ford. And the reason I say that is that both were being kind of shopped in trades, and, you know, they're guarantees in their contracts are going to be done. And, you know, you're going to see so many guys, you know, that have just signed 2 years ago in free agency that are probably, you know, saying bye-bye because, again, you know, it's going to be a very, very tough market. And, again, very difficult to see how that's going to go. So, hey, stay tuned. And, by the way, you wonder on a different front, speaking of diva wide receivers, now George Kittle is not a diva whatsoever. He's a good player and a good person. But how about Odell Beckham Jr.? He goes on the Wall Street Journal and says, we're not ready to play football, so why are we trying to push forward? He's wanting to say, we're not in the mindset to play football. So, you know, where do you think his mind is right now as far as trying to say, hey, I'm growing up here, not going to cause any problems in the locker room or anything else. And so his mind is to not play football. Nice.
Yeah. It's another thing with Odell, but hey, you know, I think his comments saying, you know, are we ready to play football, especially with all that's going on in this country, it's fair to question, mm-hmm. but for him to, you know, say that he's going to do one thing and then do the other, that's kind of weird.
Yeah, just brutal. Hey, tell your smart speaker to play 710 ESPN Seattle. Remember, you can always listen to 710 on your smart speaker or app. Coming up next, we're going to talk to ESPN's Adam Rittenberg about the very strange story about players in the Pac-12 that are threatening to opt out the season unless they can get 50% of the revenue and so many other things. So we'll talk about that next. It's the John Clayton Show, 710 ESPN Seattle.
You're listening to the Professor John Clayton.
Live from the Alaska Airlines Studios.
Streaming through the 710 Sports app and on 710sports.com.
I tell you, one of the strangest stories of the weekend certainly involves members of the Pac-12, players from the Pac-12, banding together and trying to put the onus on the Pac-12 and college football with many demands that they're going to opt out. We've already had reaction from Washington State. They basically kicked some of the kids, said, don't worry about opting out. We're going to opt out ourselves. But to get you this story, Adam Rittenberg joins us from ESPN. And Adam, I mean, this one is a strange one. Kind of go, because this came out, I guess, was a surprise. Did it come out of the blue? What happened on this?
Yeah, John, we heard whispers about this for a couple of weeks, but, you know, found out Friday night that it was, you know, a real movement, and, you know, did some reporting around it. We had the story on Saturday that it was coming, and then obviously the players went public with their list of demands on Sunday. You know, it's a wide list, as you know, ranging from a 50-50 revenue split to extended medical insurance after they're done playing, which I think is probably the most important item on there. I think some of the issues around racial injustice are significant and meaningful to this group. And so, again, I have not heard that there's actual dialogue that started between the two sides, the players and the Pac-12, but that would be the next step. They've obviously gotten their story out there. There's been quite a lot of attention on it, and it was a pretty organized effort here over the last month, including players from, you know, pretty much every Pac-12 school.
Yeah, but of course, I mean, the non-starter, of course, a 50% revenue split. I mean, that's just outrageously, I mean, in my opinion, dumb. I mean, how could you even put that demand out there?
Well, yeah, right. I mean, it's certainly going to be difficult to work that out, especially before this theoretical season in late September. But I think there's a, you know, desire to put you know, a bold list out there, and then obviously we'll see where it goes. I think there, as one coach in the league told me, they're swinging for the moon or shooting for the moon, and we'll see what they end up getting. But I don't think that item, from what I'm told, is, you know, necessarily a deal breaker as far as the players choosing to play this season or not, but, you know, it is a discussion they would like to have because they see the revenue generated by football. They see the amount of money that Larry Scott, the commissioner of the Pac-12, makes. He was actually mentioned in the list of demands. They see what their head coaches make at these schools. They see the money that's invested in these football programs, and they feel like they should be getting more of that revenue cut. 50% is obviously a lot, especially when they're also asking for, you know, some programs to be restored, like the ones that Stanford cut. So I think the money element of this is getting attention and probably the trickiest. to figure out. But I also think that some other items on there, especially around health and safety during the coronavirus and trying to play a season amid this pandemic, that, from what we've been told, is maybe even more important than the revenue part.
Well, who's advising them on this, or who do they go to try to put this all together?
So Ramogi Juma, who some people might remember was involved in the Northwestern unionization push back in 2014 and has been advocating for these types of issues, college athletes to have a bigger cut of the revenue and just a better overall experience. He's someone who's been working with this group. But again, I think it really has been player led too. I think players have been discussing this, probably privately back in the spring. And then they obviously started reaching out to one another at different programs and figured out exactly how they want to present this. And then going forward, I think a guy like Huma and maybe others will be helping them with the actual negotiations. That's sort of the unknown part of this, John. We know what the players want. We've seen their demands, but the actual operation of a negotiation, how is that going to work, and how is the Pac-12 going to respond? We'll probably learn more about that today.
Yeah, from the people you talk to, what kind of reaction is it getting?
Well, I think, some of the items make a lot of sense, and I think people in the Pac-12 realize that. I think some items are already being worked on, especially around, the racial justice part of the demand. Other items are just, again, like the reaction you had to the 50-50 revenue split ask in there is hard to get past that and see how that will work. I think one thing that I've gotten from people in the Pac-12 is that it's too broad. Focus on the items that you really want to get through in the short term, because I think what these players are saying is, right now we're in a period of time where there's still team activities, workouts, some walkthroughs, things that we want to be involved in. But then training camps are set to start as early as August 17th. We would like to have a resolution before then. Could you have a resolution on some of these items before then? Sure. Can you have a resolution on 50-50 revenue or any type of revenue agreement? That's crazy. It's not going to happen that quickly. So that's, I think, the response in those in the Pac-12. Let's figure out what we can do now and then figure out which areas or which specific demands are the most important to this group of players.
How good are some of the players that we're starting to find out about in the Pac-12 that are involved in this?
Sure. Yeah. Well, there's a number that have obviously spoken out about it, that essentially part of the group, and then others have voiced their support. So, Javon Holland of Oregon, defensive back, who is a very good player, certainly a future NFL player. He's part of this. A number of other starters around the league are, but then you see support on social media from a guy like Penei Sewell, who we'd all agree is the best player in the Pac-12, a guy who's going to be called in the first five picks of the NFL draft next year, no matter what happens to this fall season in college football. So there is support from notable players, obviously other players that are not as significant as far as on-field contributions. But I think it's a pretty good cross-section of guys that play and start and really help their teams.
I know safety certainly has to be a big issue. What things are they asking for as far as, adjusting the protocol to make it safer?
Yeah, and that was really the impetus for a lot of this, John, is that I think that they felt in talking to each other from each school that there were differences in how the schools were handling, whether it was testing or information provided or just providing assurances that these guys will be able to play a season safely, which none of us truly know, but the Pac-12 is trying to put out that they're being as careful as they can with every step of this process, but I think that the players didn't feel like it was enough. And so, I think, again, the single most important item, I think, in this list, and talking to some of the players and those in the league, is the long-term medical coverage of the players choosing that would begin 6 years after their eligibility expires. They're obviously covered while they're in college. But these guys are concerned about injuries that they have playing the game, and they're also concerned about the effects of COVID-19 long-term on their own health. And so how do they make sure that that's all covered is to really fight for this long-term insurance protection.
Yeah. What chance does that have? I'm not going to understand that the insurance while you're playing certainly goes in there, but the long-term, that's to me is a non-starter.
I think there's more discussion there. I think that is more possible with some of the revenue in the sport. I think it's a really bad look when these guys play, even before this, when they play for these college programs and they have to get surgeries after they're done and it's on their own dime. We've seen those stories before, right? And I think it's a really bad look for a sport that generates the type of revenue that college football does. So I think that is an area that I think that will certainly generate more examination. And I would imagine that there'll be some progress there.
Yeah, which, of course, I think that could be okay. But, again, that's the, I guess, unfortunately, the risk of playing because you do suffer injuries. It is football, and, again, you can't really protect that. How strong right now? Because I know in calling around, it seems like SEC, ACC, they're the strongest in going ahead, and we know what the plan is temporarily right now for the Pac-12. But how shaky can the Pac-12 season be this year because of the virus?
Right. Well, it's shaky everywhere, but I think the Pac-12, and I know the league gets a lot of criticism and justified criticism, but I think their plan for the schedule was a smart one to move the start of the season back to late September and put in some flexibility. You know, I definitely looked at it and kind of did a double take when I saw that USC and UCLA are playing in week one, Arizona State also early in the year. But in hearing Larry Scott, the commissioner, on Friday, he said the reason we did that is because those areas are right now COVID-19 hotspots. So let's provide the flexibility if that game can't take place on September 26th to move it back later in the year, either to a bye week or to the end of the season. So I think that was wise because that's obviously a priority game, but you want to do it safely. And right now, some of these areas, you can't even gather, at least in California, with a large group, much less trying to put on a football game. And so the state of California is certainly a big part of this, John, is that you have four teams in that state, and right now they have a lot of restrictions around large gatherings. And so that's something that is going to have to change in order to even have training camp probably at some schools, much less try to put on a game in late September and October.
Any word right now how they would handle it by August 17th to see what they can do and what they can't do?
Well, right. I mean, I think the start date for opening of camps is probably going to be different place to place, depending on what's going on locally, what's going on your campus, and what's going on your team. And we've had a number of teams in college football have to stop workouts over the last few weeks because of either a bunch of positive tests or some contact tracing and quarantine that had to go into effect because, the wrong person tested positive, those types of things. I think, again, if these teams can get through the next few weeks in areas where the virus is not spiking and you can start your training camp on August 17th, I think many coaches are going to do that. But I think the four schools in California are worth watching. I mean, in talking to a few folks there, they can't do a whole lot right now. Even some of the work in this walkthrough phase is going to be difficult for those schools to do. And unless things change in the next few weeks, they're not going to be able to start training camp on the 17th.
Adam Rittenberg from ESPN. What do you have on the site right now at ESPN.com?
Sure. We have our news story that we're updating on the Pac-12 situation, obviously monitoring what's going on at Washington State as well regarding Cassidy Woods and Nick Rolovich. And then obviously we'll be having a piece later this week just looking at all the different decisions that went into the scheduling at the Power Five.
Very good. Hey, Adam, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, John.
Hey, be sure to check out the Professor's Notes on 710sports.com. The Professor's Notes are brought to you by Infinity of Tacoma at Fife. Coming up next, we're going to go behind the lines and get you updated on what's going on in the National Football League. John Clayton Show, 710 ESPN Seattle.
You're listening to the Professor, John Clayton.
Live from the Alaska Airlines Studios.
Streaming through the 710 Sports app and on 710sports.com.
Well, news coming out right now on the Seahawks, probably a good thing. Brandon Jackson ended up coming back to the team. Remember, they cut him a couple weeks ago, and he was at the $2.133 million salary. So my guess is he came back for the minimum, probably making about, for his year of experience, $825,000. And so, they do get him back, and, of course, they do get the savings of over, $1.3 million. And so, adding to the defensive line and coming back, I think that's a good move right there. We'll see if they do the same thing with Joey Hunt. It would not be surprising if they maybe try to bring him back if he's willing to take the minimum. And the reason he was making $2.133, he had enough playing time, during his stay here that you can get escalators in your base salary in your contract. And so now with that in mind, Joey Hunt can be back and play. And so, makes sense. And, team is not really getting much of a cap hit on that, because remember, there was really no signing bonus or anything else. So good to get him back, and now we'll see about Joey Hunt, Curtis.
Yeah, and I believe with this move, John, the Seahawks now have 79 roster spots mm-hmm. accounted for, so they've got
room. What's that kind of tell you?
They've got room for one guy.
Yeah, and again, it's like if you bring somebody else in, then you let somebody go. And so far, knock on wood, that they've not had anybody that's tested positive. And of course, if anybody tests positive, they end go on the list for they kind of go on a reserve list. And then of course, once they're back, then you have to kind of cut somebody to make room for them. So yeah, I think that you can see maybe a little bit of pre-thinking in this. That don't be surprised now if Joey Hunt comes back. So thought that's kind of good.
Yeah, and so it gives the Seahawks depth on that defensive line, or depth that they had already. So just another guy out there in Brandon Jackson, somebody who's familiar with the system, which is what Pete and John love to do, is find guys who know how the Seahawks operate, and Jackson definitely familiar with that. I think if they do bring back Joey Hunt, he fits that mold as well, because he spent his entire NFL career so far with the Seahawks, and they seem to enjoy the depth that he brings across that offensive line. So just reading the writing on the wall, John, it kind of feels as though Jackson is kind of a precursor to maybe Joey Hunt coming back.
Yeah, because again, having the roster purposely at 78, and it gave Joey Hunt more than a week to go see if there's interest on other teams, and apparently there just wasn't, or at least nothing that was good enough that he was able to agree to sign anywhere or anything of that nature. So I think now that 80th man on the roster is going to probably end up being Joey Hunt, but getting Brandon Jackson back, I think, is a good thing, because now, again, gives them more depth on the defensive line, a guy that has a chance to make the team and not make the $2.1 million. Again, what's been pretty interesting, even more guys that are opting out today, Juwan James, right tackle of the Denver Broncos, he's decided to opt out for the season. Carolina, Christian Miller, an offensive lineman who was a draft choice in 2019, a fourth-round pick, he opted out. A couple other moves that happened, of course, Brian Winters, the guard offensive lineman for the New York Jets, he got cut, and so he was a third-round pick in 2013, and so now all of a sudden you're looking at an offensive line that's definitely now going to have four new starters, and basically five out of the top seven are all going to be new. That's going to be tough. Over the weekend, we saw the eighth member of the New England Patriots opt out. That's Matt Castle. So he's opted out. And so what you wonder about is that the Patriots drafted 10 players right now. A majority of them are almost being penciled in as starters, because they've lost their top four linebackers, they've lost two of their top three safeties, on opt outs or trades. Like DeJuan Harmon was traded to Detroit, and Eugene Chung was opted out. They've now lost Marquise Lee at wide receiver, Matt Castle at tight end. And so that team, I counted up, at the very least, they've got to find nine starters, and, either on the street or whatever. Supposedly there's some interest in Delanie Walker. Some people thought maybe with the top four linebackers of the team gone, that maybe they go for Jadeveon Clowney, but I don't see that happening. But right now the Patriots are a mess.
Yeah, they are. They've got a lot of holes to fill. With all those players opting out. And John, speaking of the opt-outs in the NFL moving up the opt-out date to, I believe, this Wednesday?
It was. Well, that's still to be determined, because what's going on is that they're still trying to figure out exactly get the deal done. Because the way it's supposed to work is that you have 7 days after you get the opt-out agreement. And right now the opt-out agreement is still not done. And so that being the case, now they have to kind of figure out what's going to be next. And, you know, so, and then I don't know why Devin McCourty was just absolutely stupid over the weekend complaining. It's like, well, the NFL is trying to cheat us by moving it up. The date was supposed to be August 1st. Right. And once you get past August 1st, you know, they any opt outs now come at the expense of the player, not the team or the league. And so him complaining about that just did not make any sense.
No. And I think we're probably going to see a few more guys opt out before the NFL decides on just how they're going to go about this. And then, John, also in the world of football, we get the news today that The Rock, Dwayne Johnson, and also an investment firm, Redbird Capital, have combined to buy the XFL for $15 million, much cheaper than the $500 million investment given by Vince McMahon at the start of the league. But, John, when you hear a name like The Rock, he's obviously well entrenched in the world of Hollywood. He also is pretty entrenched in the world of the NFL. He played football, you know, at the University of Miami and stuff. Did you, when you heard the news today that The Rock was taking over the XFL, do you think that is a good sign that that league could get resurrected here?
I think so. I mean, the only thing that's going to hurt is that how many colleges are going to be playing in the spring and kind of going up against them. So that could hurt a little bit. But, you know, they generated $200 million of revenue last year. And, of course, he was able to get it, and I think he brings credibility. Now, as long as he gets a good commissioner, I mean, I don't know if they can get Oliver Luck back or not, but that would be a good commissioner to go get. But, you know, he got it for $150 million. I think they had to absorb, like, about $8.5 million of liability from some other things. But, no, I think it's good to see The Rock do it. I know I was in the movie Game Plan with him and got to know him, and great, great guy. So, he's a football guy all the way through, even though he went into wrestling and all that stuff, but I think it's a good thing. Hey, coming up next, another good thing. We're going to catch up on the Seahawks with Joe Fan from NBC Sports Northwest. It's the John Clayton Show, 710 ESPN Seattle.